In the new book, The Business of Books, Andre Schifrin writes about how the literary world has been changed by the conglomerates that now own many publishing houses. Five major conglomerates now control 80% of American book sales. These changes have directly affected Schifrin's life. He was the longtime head of Pantheon Books, which his father co-founded. Pantheon was later bought by Random House, which was bought a couple of years ago by the German conglomerate Bertelsmann. Schifrin was forced out of the company in 1990 after refusing to make cutbacks and other changes. In 1992, he founded a not-for-profit publishing company called The New Press. Some of the conglomerates that now own publishing companies also own movie and TV companies. I asked Andre Schifrin how book sales compare with profits from the other media.
Right. Well, that's in a way one of the problems, because books are really a relatively small percentage of the sales of these very large corporations. Overall, for the country as a whole, we sell about $21, $22 billion worth of books a year, which is, you know, like a seventh and an eighth of the Time AOL annual sales altogether. So book publishing is still a relatively small industry in comparison to the other media holdings, and not that profitable a one, which is, of course, a major problem for the people who belong to conglomerates, because how are they going to get investments from their owners? How are they going to get enthusiasm when all they can do is come up with a very piddly amount of money at the end of the year?
So how has this affected the amount of profits that book publishing companies are expected to make, those publishing companies that are now part of conglomerates?
Right. Well, that's the key to the change in publishing. For most of the century, publishers really made, you know, 4, maybe 5% on an average. It was like having a savings bond or an ordinary savings account. And people went into publishing for all sorts of reasons, but making a big amount of money was not the major reason. And that 4 or 5%, by the way, is the average from the most commercial to the most esoteric firms. Nowadays, the large conglomerates understandably expect to make as much money from publishing as they do from the other holdings. So they want 15 to 20%. And, of course, tripling, quadrupling, quintupling the amount of profit that you get is very, very difficult, and very few of them have been able to do that and to do it successfully. But they've try to alter the nature of publishing so as to allow for that kind of increase.
Do you ever wonder why international conglomerates want to buy book publishing companies in the first place if the profits usually aren't that great there?
Well, there are all sorts of reasons there, and a lot of this is mythology, of course. I remember once asking a friend who was very high up in the Time Warner world and said, how did the people who owned the firm go from rent-a-car in funeral parlors, which is where they started, to movies? And he said, oh, well, they wanted to be in business with dames, at least live dames. And in a way, that's a little bit, publishing has always had that appeal, not necessarily genuine sex appeal, but the appeal of something more picturesque, more interesting, and of course the illusion of synergy, the idea that if you own a publishing house, you can then get the movie rights and so on to the books that you publish. That's what led Miramax, for instance, to set up Talk and Talk Books, the idea that you'd have a kind of synergy, that the books would turn into films. And of course, that's relatively rare, and there are agents involved and so on, so things don't quite work out. I mean, I don't really see, you know, the latest Talk bestseller, Martin Amis's memoirs, you know, turning into a long feature movie about Martin Amis's teeth. I think it's hard to do that. But there is that illusion. And, of course, the other factor is that the foreign firms, like the German firms, want to get out of German. They want to get into English. That's the world language. That's the language of the future. And so they're willing to take huge risks to buy into the U.S. And the two major German conglomerates, Holzbrink and Bertelsmann, have moved, you know, many, many billions of dollars into the U.S. in order to do that.
So do you think that international conglomerate ownership of American publishing companies is affecting what is published here?
Oh, absolutely. There is an enormous change, and I've tried not to be hyperbolic or just to go on my subjective feelings, and I've looked at the catalogs. I've looked at the catalogs for 1950, 60, 70, and 2000 for the major firms, and there's a chapter in the book devoted to the changes that have taken place among just the three biggest firms, and it's replicated throughout the industry. And it is really unbelievable. I mean, even I was shocked when I looked, for instance, the Harper catalog for 1960, 1950. It was really incredibly impressive. They had dozens and dozens of history books, of books on philosophy, on theology, on art criticism. They published some of the major authors of our time. And, you know, but so did Simon & Schuster, and so did Random House to a lesser degree. If you look now at the catalogs of those firms, you just don't see those books. They've disappeared.
What do you see instead?
Well, you see pretty much what you see on the bestseller list and what you see in the bookstores. That is, you see a lot of would-be bestsellers, the Stephen Kings and so on, that we all are familiar with. You see still a lot of fiction that people hope will be commercial, but you don't see any of the experimental or foreign fiction that these firms used to publish. You see a lot of how-to. You look at the Harper Collins catalog, they have something called Harper Entertainment, which had last year 136 volumes, including, you know, the Jerry Springer picture book and so on and so forth. You know, that comes from a firm that used to publish the major history and theology and so on of our time. So the shift, if you put those catalogs side by side, is pretty phenomenal.
What about the place of independent publishing companies and university presses? And the independent companies and the university presses stand outside of the conglomerization of publishing.
Right. Well, you know, one of the sad things about writing this book is that increasingly the examples that I give of marvelous independents who are still doing a good job, you know, changes with every month. So that the number of the traditional firms, the older firms that are independent, is really dwindling. There are very, very few of them left. On the other hand, and it's an important and encouraging sign, there are a lot of new small firms being started, mostly by very young people throughout the country. I remember going to Minneapolis the other year for a meeting with a bunch of independent publishers, and there were four of them that were based in Minneapolis, and they were run by young people, some of whom had been corporate lawyers, and others who decided there was more to life than simply making money, and they wanted to try the traditional kind of publishing. So I find that very encouraging. And of course, these firms are increasingly coming up with a larger and larger percentage of the interesting and important books.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andre Schifrin. He's the former managing director of Pantheon, and he's the founding director of The New Press. He's written a book about publishing called The Business of Books. Your father was in publishing. He was born in Russia, went to France after World War I, began his career as a publisher and translator there. He worked with André Gide on translations. But after the German invasion of France, he was forced out because he was Jewish. You were about six at the time when your family left the country and then eventually wound up in the United States. In the U.S., your father joined a new book company called Pantheon, and that's the company that you ended up working at for, I think, about 30 years. What was the goal when your father joined Pantheon, when it was a brand new company?
Right. Well, Pantheon started in 1942, really as an exile publishing firm. It was started by Kurt Wolff, who was a very distinguished German publisher who had published Kafka and so on in Germany, and who had also been forced to leave because of some Jewish ancestry in his family. And they started publishing books in German as well as in English. And then my father had been publishing books in French, books from the French Resistance, books that were being published clandestinely in France. And so the original books were really attempts to show to Americans that there was a culture, there was a politics going on during the Second World War, even under the German occupation, that they should know about. But after a while, Pantheon, you know, developed titles that did much better in the U.S., and eventually they were to publish Dr. Zhivago and The Tin Drum and a number of other books that became huge bestsellers. So it was an attempt at the beginning to fill the gap, a very real gap that existed in wartime America, about what was going on in Europe, what had gone on in Europe. And then, you know, at times, it doesn't always happen, but virtue was rewarded, and they got a lot of bestsellers that made huge successes.
Now, as an example of the fact that takeovers in publishing is nothing new, Pantheon was purchased by Random House back in 1961.
Right.
Do you think the company changed by that takeover?
Well, Pantheon at that stage had finished a first stage. The Wolves, who were the chief editors, had left. It was sort of in limbo, and it was very profitable because of the books they had brought in, and the stockholders figured this was the time to sell out and make some money, which they did. But what was interesting in the takeover is that Random House didn't just amalgamate it or make us part of Knopf, as Pantheon now is. They said, no, do what you can. Start off on your own. See what you can publish. See what a new generation can do with this kind of heritage. And, you know, I was all of 26 at the time, and because I suppose I was so young, it didn't occur to me that this was a crazy thing for anyone to do, to entrust a publishing house to someone that age. But Random House was incredibly supportive, as I say in the book, and we were able to publish, I think, some of the most important books being published from Europe and from the U.S. at the time, ranging from Michel Foucault to Noam Chomsky and Gunnar Myrdal and so on, a list of which I'm very proud to this day. But it wouldn't have been possible if Random House initially hadn't been that supportive. And that was, you know, the difference between then and now. They were willing not to make any money for a while. They were willing to let the company grow. They were willing to see what young people could do. And they were marvelously supportive. Bennett Cerf and Donald Klopfer and the other people I write about. Nowadays, when you buy a firm, you fire the staff, you keep the backlist insofar as it's profitable, and you more or less destroy its identity. When HarperCollins bought Morrow and Avon the other day, they had 200 people on staff. You know, they got rid of 120. No one even mentioned it anymore. It didn't even make a paragraph in the Times. It's just taken for granted.
The business of business is usually to make money. And you're criticizing publishing for being too involved now with the goal of making money at the expense of bringing out the books that you think companies ought to be bringing out. Why should publishing be different from any other businesses and pay less attention to the bottom line than any other business?
Right. Well, the idea of profit maximization is, on the whole, a relatively new one. It's now that everybody is on the stock market and that everything is globalized, that you're competing all the time with how much money can you make if you invest it in China rather than here, and so on and so forth. But in publishing, there's also the fact that if you're going to look to the future, if you're going to develop authors, if you're going to find new ideas, new people, you have to take these risks. And if you don't, it's not going to work. And one of the interesting things is, if you look at what happened to Random House in the last years of New House and to HarperCollins and so on, they made less money than ever. When Random House was finally sold to Bertelsmann, their profit was 0.1% that year, and they'd written off $80 million worth of books that they knew would never earn back their advance. So it's not necessarily even good business. But even if it were, I think publishing, like radio, like TV, has a kind of social responsibility. We're not licensed by the federal government, and nobody would ever want that to happen. But there are a lot of programs that help publishers that come from public monies, whether it's library purchases or school book purchases or cheaper postal rates and so on. As with all print, the assumption since the revolution has been that the dissemination of knowledge is something that is worthy of government support in that respect. Publishing has gone very far from betraying that trust and in a way betraying that investment.
What's one thing you understand now about authors that you think you didn't understand until you wrote your book?
How oversensitive they are. You read every review, with your teeth clenched and worried about it. It makes a difference whenever you get a phone call from somebody who says, I just read your book and I agree with what you say. I've always tried to encourage and praise our authors and occasionally to hide a negative review from them. But I've learned, I think, this way, how very sensitive you are about anything you've written.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it was a great pleasure. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Andre Schifrin is the founding director of The New Press. His new book is called The Business of Books. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by the hard rock band Queens of the Stone Age. This is Fresh Air.